read about four or five of them in the last couple of days.
The Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, this is January 25th, 2011. Today, members, we're going to be listening on overviews from the Tax Court, Uniform Laws Commission, and the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Our first witness today is Judge George Perez from the Tax Court. Judge, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, senators. My name is George Perez. I'm the Chief Judge of the Minnesota Tax Court. To my left is Lisa Feister. She's the Tax Court Administrator.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I know that I've testified here previously at other times, but for those who have not heard my testimony or are less familiar with the Tax Court, I will do an overview, and I apologize for those who are familiar with the Tax Court, and this is something you've heard many times already. I'll start off by saying that the Tax Court is situated in St. Paul. It consists of three judges, three staff people. To my left is one of those staff people. We serve all 87 counties. We travel to the other 86 counties. We hear two types of cases primarily, those that we call property tax appeals, and those all range from your residential property that's owner-occupied all the way to commercial property, Mall of America, the Metrodome, Target Center, commercial property, and everything in between. So those all fall under property tax appeals. And basically what we hear is issues involving valuation, classification, exemption issues, and other miscellaneous types, homestead considerations. That's the bulk of our cases. We hear another type of case that comes directly from the Department of Revenue that we call commissioner cases. And those involve anything from individual income tax to sales and use tax, corporate nexus, and other miscellaneous taxes. Those comprise less of our caseload, but they are significant in this regard. After every legislative session, the legislature passes or amends or changes statutes, and in some cases, tax statutes. And those are the very first, and we're the very first to receive those types of cases when the taxpayers are challenging the interpretation, the reading, and the application of the new or amended tax statute. And so we get a slew of those after every session. What was passed ahead of time that should be before you is a one sheet entitled Minnesota Tax Court Total Case Filings and Hearings. I wanted to go back to 2007 just to give senators and the chair a perspective on this to see the kind of growth that we've experienced in a very short period of time. If you look just briefly at 2007, we had over 2,300 cases filed. In 2008, that went up to 29. 2009, that went up to 4,800. And last year, which we're still tabulating, it's going to come out to close to 6,000 filings. Below that is the hearings. When we get a case filed, then that triggers a set of hearings. And, of course, each case is different. We have complex cases, simpler cases, large ones, smaller ones. And they all require different types of hearings that are involved. For example, in 2009, we had 4,800 filings and 3,600 hearings. In 2010, that changed a little bit. We had 57 filings and over 6,200 hearings. And by hearings, I mean everything that's done on the case. From the moment the case gets filed, Lisa takes that case, puts it in our calendar, and we start getting calls on it, and we will have a pretrial motions. We may have two or three of those. motions to dismiss, motions to compel discovery, all kinds of litigation-related motions before it actually goes to trial. Of course, many cases do settle. The ones that don't go to actual trial. I've been asked before, how long do the trials take, and how quickly our cases cycle through the court? Well, they range, but the average trial under the property tax appeal category, they take about a week, 4 days, maybe 5 or 6 days is what they take. Commissioner cases, they take about 2 to 3 days, and they cycle in and out of our court from the time we get them within about a year, give or take, but about a year, and we pride ourselves in trying to get those out no longer than a year. Some are exceptional if they're more complex or complicated, but that's the average case we'll get in, get out within a year. The third category that I have on the list here is pro se filings, and I note that because of the particular challenge pro ses present. Pro ses are litigants that do not have attorneys for a variety of reasons, can't afford one, doesn't make sense to have one given the amount of money, and other reasons. Some people just choose to go it alone and present their cases in court, which they're allowed to under our judicial system. However, they range from the most sophisticated litigants who have businesses and do other things and can function and proceed relatively well, I guess, through the process, to those that have very little idea of what they're doing. They call us often, long questions, requires more time on behalf of the judge. They take longer. There's more explanation. So they present a special challenge and difficulty, and that's why I highlight those, because while they may represent one case, it's a different type of case, and even if it's a simple issue, it can take 2 or 3 times the amount of time that it would take to litigate another issue where you've got attorneys representing and litigating the case. And those have steadily gone up as well. Certainly within the last couple of years, they've gone up 715 last in 2009, and they dropped a little to 590 in 2010. I will give the caveat that we're still tabulating final numbers for 2010. So our numbers have gone up. People have asked, you know, what's the reason for that, especially the dramatic increase certainly within the last couple of years. And there are at least two reasons for that. The first reason is that whenever we're at such a balance with the economy, when the economy goes down, our caseload goes up. People are challenging paying taxes like they challenge any other cost that they incur and they have in their lives and in their personal budgets. And the same thing with businesses. This is an area where if they feel they can cut their taxes, they're going to. And that's certainly reasonable. But that's one of the reasons why when it's a tougher economy, you have more people challenging their taxes and their tax liability. The other reason, again, because we have property tax appeals, the proverbial real estate bubble burst 2008, 2007, right around there. And what happened was that led to a flood of cases because suddenly the assessed value was a lot higher than what property was starting to sell for because the market was dropping. And the assessors, while they're doing the best they can, they're dropping it year by year. Of course, the market doesn't work that way. It moves a lot quicker than year by year. So there's adjustments being made. And as a result, more people are filing than ever before. More people that never used to file or would not file in those circumstances where they thought that their assessment was out of line with what the current market rates were. Just a word or two about our budget. For the biennium, for 2012 and 2013, which is what we're here for, I do understand that it's still ongoing, that our court is under the executive branch, so I will need to meet and talk to our budget director and liaisons from the governor's office to see if an allotment can be adjusted. We are a little bit short at this time in meeting our expenses with the allotment that has been made. It's not a lot. And certainly, given the enormity of the budget and the budget deficit, we're facing about $15,000 to $16,000 shortfall, which the only way to make that up would require the court to shut down. We don't have any other kinds of programs or things that we run that we could say, well, let's shut this down for a couple of years. We have three staff and three judges, and that's all we have. And we certainly have enough to keep everyone busy, so it isn't even a consideration that we can cut somebody or have somebody temporarily leave. So I think in a nutshell, that's what the tax court is, and what our budget has been allocated at this point is $790,000. And I think to avoid the shortfall, we're looking at 806. And with that, I'll take any questions, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Judge. Let the record show that we have a quorum. Any questions for the judge? Yes, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Judge, how have you handled the massive increase in cases with the same amount of staff and a declining budget?
Judge Pritz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, with great difficulty, we have made as much use of the technology that we have. We have, even though we haven't gone completely to emailing and e-filing, we have done that where litigants are capable of doing that. We do more motions by telephonic, by phone. We use ITV wherever possible because we are required to go to the county where the cases are being litigated, where they stem from, where they're filed. Most of our cases are in the Twin Cities. They are in the metro area, but we do have about a third that are in outstate Minnesota, so it does require us to travel. So through some technology, the use of telephonic calling when we can, that's been some of the – we've done other methods to try to mainstream. We double and triple book trials and motions, so when things settle, we just go down the line on a given day. So those are some of the ways that we've attempted to handle this. And we've been preparing for this. We've seen it coming, and we know – I'm doing this for a while, that when the economy is going down, we know that this is happening. So we started sending notices out early, started scheduling way in advance. We're scheduled probably through September, October at this point.
Senator Latz.
Just a follow-up, Judge. Has there been a does it take longer now to get a case resolved in front of your court than it did in the past? And how long is the timeline?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, it does take it a little bit longer. The other thing that adds to the length of cases is obviously the advent of the Internet, and litigants have much greater access to evidence than ever before. That's one of the reasons that our cases take longer to try. Where we used to have 10, 15, 20 exhibits, we may now have 100, 200, 250 exhibits, and those have to be presented and they have to be argued and decided whether they're admitted or not. That lengthens the time of trial. So it has lengthened our time to some degree. It's made trials a little bit longer. We still try very hard for that year cycle, but probably less cases can fall under that, especially if they're bigger cases. It's just difficult to fall under that. We still are ahead of other courts that are probably even more overwhelmed with criminal cases. Ours are strictly civil cases. But they are taking a little bit longer. It is slowing us down a little bit. But we still are, you know, right now we're finishing up with 2009 filings, and we're deep into 2010 filings.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment to my fellow senators. In 2009, I was one of the pro se litigants in the Minnesota Tax Court, and I will tell you that just being exposed to their website, the staff, the help that was provided, I will tell you I was very, very pleased with the service that was provided by the Tax Court.
Did you win your case?
I did indeed.
All right. Judge, I wanted to ask a question. How many judges do you have in the tax court? Give our committee a little perspective of how large your office is.
Mr. Chair and Senator, thank you for your comment. And I would make one comment is that we also have a website which we've been developing, and that provides a lot of help. We have two pro se handbooks, one for property tax appeals, the other for commissioner cases, that walks the litigants through it so that it does reduce the amount of uncertainty and stress that they may face. We also send it to them for free. And all our cases can be found online, again, free of charge. Once we publish them, we issue them, we put them right on our website within a few days. That also expedites the process a little bit. All our rules, procedures, cases, it's all on the website. All our forms are on the website. Everything is on there. That also cuts back on our cost a little bit. That's another measure that we thought putting everything out there, then the litigants print it out, the firms that can afford it, they print out these things and they fill them out and then they send them in, and that saves a little bit of time. Okay. But, Mr. Chair, in terms of your question, we have three full-time judges, and that's all we have. That's all we do. We don't have any other occupation, anything else that we do. And we have three staff. The three staff do not correspond, you know, one to each judge. There are three that do very distinct things. For example, Lisa handles all setting up all the cases for all the motions, every motion that's heard, last year, all 6,255, she schedules with the judges and continuances and follows up on that. We have another. The other thing is that we have one of the few places that still answers calls, and that's why when people call, you don't get a matrix that we all experience and can grow frustrated with that. You actually get a live person that answers the phone, and they will direct you. A lot of times we get calls from the Department of Revenue saying, well, we can't reach anybody there. Can we talk to somebody over here? And we'll say, well, you could, but your matter really belongs there. But I know what it's like when you get a live person. That makes a big difference. And we still want to be able to hang on to that particular service as long as we can. And we're still able to. You know, part of our job is to answer the phones, and the other part is to input every one of these cases, every one of the actions that happens on every one of the cases, and then all the other miscellaneous things that have to get done in the court. So it's a pressure cooker there, and there's a lot going on. But I think through technology, it's helped us a great deal.
So, Judge, let me just get this right. You have 5,700 cases that are filed. You've got three judges and three staff handling all that. Plus, you're kind of on a circuit rider type function that you have to go all around the state and have hearings at different localities in order to serve the public.
That's correct. And in addition, I think we're the only, I'm pretty sure that we are the only, I could be stand corrected on this, but I am, we're the only court that does not have law clerks, which are, clerks are what mm-hmm. help the judges right. with research and writing and those kinds of things. We do not have law clerks. Occasionally, we're able to secure a law intern for a semester, which is 3 months, and then they go back to school. And they're there only for 6 hours a week, which is as much time as they can give us.
Sure. Well, thank you. Any other questions for the judge? Hearing none, we'll move on with our schedule. Thank you, Judge, for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senators.
Next would be a Uniform Laws Commission. For some of you who are new on the committee, Bob Tennyson is a former state senator. He served on the Judiciary Committee for a while, and he gives me plenty of old stories about how the judiciary really should be run in this committee. Senator Tennyson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'd like to introduce Dean Harry Hainsworth from William Mitchell Law School. Harry's been a commissioner now for many years from Minnesota, and previously he was a commissioner from State Illinois when he was the dean at a law school in Illinois. And Harry's going to start off for our testimony.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator.
Dean.
Just a little bit about the background on the commissions on uniform state laws. It has existed since 1892, and each state is entitled to have a minimum of three commissioners. So Bob Tennis and I are two of the nine commissioners in Minnesota. We are officially a state agency. We exist by statute. The appointments are made jointly by the governor, the attorney general, and the chief justice of the Supreme Court.
Pardon me, Dean. We're having a little trouble on the tape hearing your voice, so if you could just speak up a little bit, and we'll
thank you. I'll try
hold
to.
It a little closer, and I'm sure we'll
thank
do
you,
fine.
Senator. The Minnesota now has enacted 130 of the uniform acts that have been adopted over the years, and we will have five before the legislature this year, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. What's so important about what the work we do is that these uniform acts are acts that are designed to be adopted across the country, and they deal with major infrastructure issues that a state needs to deal with. And in effect, we provide a very important role for providing the implementation of our federalism system. If it weren't for the acts that we design and promulgate and get adopted around the states, you'd see a whole lot more federal intrusion into the legislative process or the ability to states to legislate. There's so many things connected with interstate commerce, but that is sort of a basic bedrock principle where we've been able to, over the period of time, maintain the state ability to legislate in an enormous range of areas where if we weren't there, didn't have acts, the federal government would have a mandated act that would be across the board, across the country. So that's perhaps one of the most important roles that we do play, besides the fact that we provide very, very important legislation that is very carefully crafted and is designed to be enacted across the country. And Bob, if you would describe a little bit about the process that we go through.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Chairman, Tennessee. Members of the committee. Let me explain a little bit of the structure of the conference, and you'll see how it fits in. The conference is governed by an executive committee, and as a president of the conference, who happens to be Bob Stein, formerly of the University of Minnesota Law School. He's chair of the executive committee. We have a scope and program committee, which is also a management committee. They screen all proposals and ideas for projects that we might undertake. They make some judgments about that and pass those recommendations on to the executive committee. Then we have a legislative committee, which I chair. Our job is to get the legislation passed across the country, and have a staff of four lawyers in Chicago that I'm responsible for. The way it works is that we get ideas from anywhere. We get them submitted by commissioners. We get them from the American Bar Association. We may get them from any place. We've had them come from a lot of different sources. We look at those proposals to determine whether or not they fit our criteria. Is it something that could be universally adopted? Is it important? Is it significant enough? And so on. We go through that analysis. And is it likely that we can get people who have an interest in this issue to participate in the drafting process? Assuming we do that, the Scope and Program Committee, which I also serve on, reviews those and makes a recommendation to the Executive Committee. And then on the Executive Committee, which I also serve on, we make a decision whether we go forward with the project and whether we can fund it and so on, because it does cost money. Assuming we've done that, we may appoint a study committee to look into the project to figure out whether or not everybody who might be interested in it is willing to participate. Because the only way we can draft an act and get it adopted is if we get consensus and buy-in. We don't have any power to do anything beyond that. So assuming that's the case, we will do a study. And that's usually done by telephone or with a few people involved. And then it may come back to the scope and program, and we recommend a drafting committee. If a drafting committee is appointed, the president makes the appointment. There's about eight or nine commissioners are appointed to that. We hire a reporter who's usually a law professor who specializes in that area, and they work for a pittance. I mean, I'm really a pittance. We give them a stipend of, I think we went from $1,500 to $5,000. They might work 4 years for that amount of money. And they do a lot of the drafting. The committee meetings then, all of our information is public. It's on our website. You can look at any of the other drafts and so on. We then solicit everybody who we think might have an interest, any group that has an interest in that topic, to come and participate and sit at the table with us through the drafting process. We also have a formal relationship with the American Bar Association whereby they appoint representatives to the committee. So they participate and they report back to the bar sections and so on, so we get that kind of feedback. And that's the way it was supposed to work. And anybody else can participate. In addition, on uniform commercial code projects, we also have a formal relationship with the American Law Institute, which is another group of lawyers and judges and so on, who participate in that. Okay, the committees then meet for about 2.5 days on a weekend. We meet Friday, Saturday, and Sunday morning and go home. We do that 2 or 3 times a year, and we have the drafts there, and everybody who wants to come can participate and review the language and, you know, look at the policy and debate it. And after about 2 years of this work, which is typically the case, and we think we have a draft that's ready to be read at an annual meeting, it's brought to the annual meeting, which is a week-long meeting, and it's read by the committee line by line before the assembled the body. There's 200 to 300 people there. So they look at these and criticize them and say, well, you haven't thought of this. This is unclear. This is a policy question, so on. So they get criticized constructively from a lot of different sources. The committee then goes back for another year and has another meeting or two to clean up and address the problems that were raised in that annual meeting. And when that's done, then it's brought back and read a second time at another annual meeting. And only then do the states vote on whether or not to approve it and promulgate it. And that's how it goes. But it's a 2 to 3 year process typically. Some have been longer, some have been shorter, but that's typically the way it works. So when we come with an act, hopefully the language has been carefully drafted, the issues have been carefully vetted, and it's clear. So that's how we get an adoption. And usually we try to make sure that people who have an interest in issue, know how it works, are on board so we don't run into opposition.
Let me pick up with that if I might.
Yes, Dean.
Senator. Bob took us through the process of promulgating the act by the commissioners. When we go to the states, we then have to get the acts introduced into the legislatures of the various states. And a process we follow in Minnesota is that the primary group we work with, other than legislators, is the Minnesota State Bar Association and our revisor's office. And any interesting group like the Secretary of State when you've got issues relating to filing or elections and things of that nature. So we have a careful vetting of the act at the state level. The purpose of that is to make sure that whatever you're doing is going to fit in with the state policies and state procedures, and it's drafted in accordance with the way that it should be drafted for a Minnesota Act. So, if you will, it gets Minnesotaized before we actually get it introduced into the legislature. And that sometimes takes a year or more to do. And to give you one example, one of the acts that we're going to be introducing this year is the Uniform Limited Liability Company Act, dealing with what are called LLCs. And that went through a 4-year process by the commissioners, and then it's gone through a year and a half at the state level with Minnesota Bar Association. I happened to be on the committee that was reviewing it, and we met for 2 hours every third week for over a year, to give you an idea of how frequently we met. And on that committee as well was one of the representatives from the Secretary of State's office, because they have a very real interest in this and how it works. So now when we introduce it, and the revisor's office will draft it, of course, but when it's introduced, I think you can have some assurance that it's been carefully vetted, not only from a national perspective, where you've got people from all over the country looking at it, but also at the state level from the people that are going to be working with it once it's adopted. And that's one reason why you don't normally have a lot of amendments proposed to the Uniform Acts once we introduce them, because we will take care of that before they're actually introduced. If there's going to be a problem, we see it in the state, we'll try to get that in the bill before we actually introduce it. Now, Bob might mention something else. We're appointed, but we don't get any compensation for anything we do. We get reimbursed for travel expenses going to the drafting committee meetings. For example, I'm going to San Antonio this weekend, and we're doing something. If anybody understands the Uniform Commercial Code, we're doing the same thing for all the business entity acts, and I'm in charge of that drafting committee. But anyway, go down and I get my travel expenses paid, but that's it. And Bob, you were telling me, how many hours did you work last year on commissioner's work?
I have a lot of committee responsibilities, and I do keep track of that just for my law firm purposes, and it was 416 hours last year.
And I had maybe not that many, but a whole lot. But that all the commissioners in Minnesota really do work and work very hard. That brings me a little bit to talk about our budget. The last several years, and I think this is on page of the handout that we had, we have now a current request, and it's a one-year request that we give. It would be $51,200 for all the work that the commissioners do. The last couple of years, it's going back to fiscal 2009, it was $44,000. It's gone up very little. The legislature, however, and we understand the issues, in the last 2 years has only authorized about half of what our request is. But if you look at the amount of time that's spent and the products that we produce and the high level of success these acts have in Minnesota, that's not very much money for what you're getting out of it. You're really getting something that in most of these acts could never be drafted at the state level. They're just too complex. There are too many issues that have to be dealt with. So individual states couldn't draft them. So you have to have some organization like commissioners to do that.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add on that assessment, the dues are assessed by the conference basically on the population of the states, and there are several tiers. And that's where the $51,000 comes in. I think the highest assessment is $148,000 or something like that for California. And that money goes to the national organization to help pay for all of the work that's being done. When Harry talked about travel reimbursement, when we travel on committee business, we're reimbursed personally for our travel expenses by the conference. We are reimbursed directly by the state to attend the annual meeting. And in that $51,000, whatever it is also the we have our travel monies in there for our annual meeting. And that's the only cost to the state for us personally for the time we spend on that is a pay to travel to go to the annual meeting.
And by the way, it does not cover all our expenses.
Yeah, no, it's a $35 food for, and usually it goes through that by noon, but
could you repeat that into the record?
If I might, Senator, just one brief thing. If you look on pages 7 and 8 of the handout, you'll see the acts that we are proposing to introduce this year, and there's one more that's come up subsequently that the Bar Association wants us to present. But if you look at them, I mentioned the Revised Uniform Limited Liability Company Act. They're the Uniform Commercial Code, Article 9 amendments. These are very technical amendments, but they are quite important, and it's very important that that be adopted uniformly across the country. The Uniform Collateral Consequences of Convictions Act, this is a very meaty issue. We're not saying what kinds of collateral consequences there should be, but we're talking about the process of making sure that these are systematized and that defendants are aware of what they are and that the legislature is aware of what they are, bringing it all together in a single package. The Uniform Interstate Family Support Act deals with – we already have the 96 Act, but you need to have updated because of some international conventions as well as some congressional legislation. And that deals with – you've got custody issues and child support issues across state lines, about which state is going to have the major role in this and who's going to issue the orders and how you make sure that there are collections and things like that. And this is not only interstate, but it also is international as well. The other act that we're going to introduce is one that is called the Uniform Disposition of Community Property Rights at Death Act. Now, that's a really technical one, but it's one that the probate section of the bar thinks is very important to have because it deals with what happens in a community property state when a spouse dies. And Wisconsin happens to be a community property state. Minnesota is not, and they run into a lot of problems about how you handle these issues when they're residents, say, of Minnesota at the time of death. So, these kinds of things are very technical, but they're very important to have in the state legislation.
And, Mr. Chairman, I'm making an offer here to anybody to be an author of these bills. So anybody wants to work on these, we're happy to have you volunteer.
Senator Tennyson, do you have any takers?
I just happen to have the sign take jackets here.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I just would like to ask a question. Forgive me if you said it earlier. But I noticed that I think there were like 11 years between when Commissioner Hennig was appointed and the previous one was Commissioner Timmons. Is it a lifetime appointment or is it something you do until you can't do it anymore?
It just seems that way.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, no, it's not a lifetime appointment
Okay. Initially.
The terms are for 2 years.
Oh.
And I was appointed and reappointed by various governors and chief justices and attorney generals over the years. And then after 20 years, the conference has a rule that if you've been a commissioner for 20 years and you've behaved properly, there's another way to say that, you can ask for life appointment. And I was made a life member a couple of years ago. Under Minnesota statute, then also I'm a life member, so don't have to get reappointed anymore.
So, Senator Tennyson, it's kind of like Congress then.
Mr. Chairman.
The House of Lords. Mr. Chairman, I think it's like the House of Lords in London.
I've carried a few of the uniform bills, and I have to say, I mean, I'm impressed with the work, and I think the chairman should consider seeking an appointment.
Seeking appointment? Is that what you said?
Not until you, of course, you leave the legislature. But although Senator, you can be a sitting, sitting senator.
Mr. Chairman, there would be a problem with that. They don't want anybody who's not a lawyer.
I wondered, but you'd be a natural. I know you don't tend to like uniform.
We're going to take a vote on this.
Laws, if I'm not mistaken. But I admire the work. I mean, the incredible work and the poring over. These words is really important work, and
Well, some of us have fun sitting in a hotel room all weekend arguing about that. But some people think we should get a life. But that's
I'll consider it. Senator Scheid, I just wanted the members to know that I have had a long time coming around to the concept of why we need a uniform law commission in the first place. And yet at the same time, when you look at the complexity of business and that goes on in the country and going across state lines and trying, the word uniformity comes with trying to make states be able to enforce either contracts or civil law relationships in a uniform way so that if there's transactions that go across state line, there's at least some uniformity that has a network of law that you can find in one state as well as another. I get that. And yet at the same time, I used to think that the Uniform Laws Commission was somewhat of a esoteric, cerebral, lofty type organization, and maybe they are, but there's a purpose for them, and I still read their bills carefully, though. Any questions? Senator Ladd.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just add a thought. You highlighted one of the points I want to make about the importance to business of being able to have some common laws across state lines and common language. If nothing else, just referring to the same code number for the secured transactions that they're engaging in makes those conversations easier to comply with the laws and to enforce their business contracts around. But I would also note, if you look through the list of Uniform Acts in Minnesota, it's the major chapters that we and our citizens deal with on a regular basis every day. And even if we make changes every session in them, the basic organization and formula that put it together was the benefit, was the product of some of the best minds, some of the best thinking in the law schools and around the country as to how these things ought to be put into place to meet all the different interests that are involved in these statutes. So the rights of people are very important, and they're reflected in what we have done. We certainly have lots of expertise in Minnesota, but when you can pull together the deans, the top practitioners, the top legal theorists, and those who are the legislators, all these different parties that are involved in putting these together, we really do get the best laws that we possibly can out of these commissions.
Well said, Senator Lance. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, I just had a history question for Mr. Tennyson, and that is whether the I was not familiar with the Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act, which says it replaced the Uniform Management of Institutional Funds Act, which I presume was also a uniform law. I was wondering if the old one was imprudent and if that's why they had to make it the new one.
I'm sorry. I couldn't. I
wondered if the former one was imprudent and that's why you had to make a new prudent one.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, no, it was prudent at the time, but then the federal tax laws changed, and we had to update the act to accommodate that. And it's a very important issue because it deals with every foundation of any educational institution and others. In fact, I had a call from one of the commissioners from Michigan who happens to be a trustee at Shattuck a couple of years ago wondering whether he had adopted it yet because they had a real important issue about how to use the principal and interest from their foundation revenues to how to allocate it, because it really is a complex issue. Yeah. If I might add one other thing, just to illustrate the comprehensiveness with which we try to reach out and include everybody who has an interest in a topic. A few years ago, we adopted the Uniform Securities Act, which was an update. I was on that committee, and you know, as I said, there were about eight or nine commissioners, a couple guys from the American Bar Association, but we'd have 45 people sitting around the table. They were from the Securities and Exchange Commission, the securities industry, the Investment Association, the broker-dealers, the SEC, the Federal Reserve was there. Every agency, we had 45 people sitting around vetting this thing and raising issues from their point of view about what need to be accommodated. And that's really the only institution in the whole world that I think does that or is capable of doing that. I don't know of any other organization that has that ability and is willing to take the time to do it. And everybody serves for free.
Well, thank you, Senator Tennyson. Does your organization offer ride-along programs in case there's a member here or a researcher that may want to sit along and watch how you guys do this?
Mr. Chairman, every one of our meetings is open to the public, to anybody who wants to attend. If you wanted to participate by audio, I could probably arrange that. If you can't travel there. We've had some drafting meetings here in the Twin Cities, and perhaps if we have some more, notify people and let them, if anybody wants to attend, they can just stop in. It's really exciting.
All right.
If you got a Saturday afternoon where you can't sleep.
All right.
Yeah, you got to like it.
Well, moving along, thank you, gentlemen, for that testimony. The next group on our list is the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. And we'll be welcoming Wendy Adler Robinson, the acting commissioner. Thank you for coming, and welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Wendy Adler Robinson. I am the acting commissioner of the Department of Human Rights. And I'd like to thank you first for the opportunity to provide an agency overview to you today. The Department of Human Rights' mission is to make Minnesota discrimination free. The department pursues this mission through a coordinated program of law enforcement, prevention education, and community-based conflict resolution. We have 36 employees, and we are located in downtown St. Paul. Last September, we opened an office in St. Cloud with 1.5 full-time employees. This office is 100% funded by a St. Cloud and St. Joseph joint powers agreement, so the state does not fund our St. Cloud office. The core functions of the department are to develop and oversee statewide human rights policies and programs, receive, investigate, and make determinations on charges alleging unfair discriminatory practices. We monitor state contractor compliance with applicable affirmative action provisions. We educate to eliminate unfair discriminatory practices. We develop and disseminate technical assistance to persons subject to the provisions of the Human Rights Act. And we assess human rights compliance through voluntary settlement agreements and corrective action plans. We are 96% funded by the general fund, and of which about 85% of that is for staffing. The department derives its authority and enforcement responsibilities from the Minnesota Human Rights Act, which is Minnesota Statute 363A, and its implementing rules. We have three main departmental operations: case processing, contract compliance, and education and program development. Our case processing function is to receive and investigate charges which allege discrimination occurred in Minnesota. The compliance function is to ensure that businesses that do business with the state of Minnesota must comply with our affirmative action law. And the education and program development function is to increase the knowledge of human rights policies, practices, rights, and responsibilities of the general public. We, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, with the continued decrease in department budget, our resources have drastically diminished over the past few bienniums. We are hoping that there will not be any additional shrinkage, which would result in us having very challenging times to continue to enforce our law. With that, I would like to thank you again for the opportunity to address the committee, and I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
Commissioner, do you know when a new commissioner will be appointed?
No.
All right.
Mr. Chair, no.
Still in process. Any questions? Senator Lance.
Mr. Chair, the Department of Human Rights is often the first and often the last resort of employees in Minnesota who feel that they have been wronged by virtue of their membership in a protected class, the color of their skin, their religion, the disability, sexual orientation, marital status, all sorts of things. And, while there's a federal counterpart and they do, they have a sharing arrangement, so that if someone files a charge with the Human Rights Department in Minnesota, they have also protected their rights under federal law. The diminishing resources of the department have made it a real challenge to not only respond effectively to aggrieved employees or employees who perceive that they have been aggrieved for some particularly egregious reasons, but also to do it in a timely manner. And it's a small department, and I think you have only, what, six investigators on staff, is that?
Senator Latz, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
About 50% of the staff is the professional employees, the investigators and supervisors.
Okay. And that's for a population of over 5 million people in the state of Minnesota. Now, people get fired for all sorts of reasons, often completely unrelated to, say, the color of their skin. But you'd be surprised, I think everyone at this table would be surprised, if you found out just how many people do suffer workplace discrimination. I happen to practice in this area of law, and I'm still shocked at the cold calls that I get telling me what a supervisor did or alleged to have done that you'd think in this day and age they would have gotten it 30 or 40 years after the Civil Rights Acts were passed. And a lot of people just don't. They don't get it, or the management isn't training them properly or something. Frankly, there aren't very many places that employees can go, whether they're still employed there and experience certain, you know, sexual harassment on the job, or whether they've been fired for improper reasons. And so I just want to make a pitch that we do all we can to protect the budget of this agency. I do have a because everyone is an employee somewhere, or hopefully will be soon. But I do have one question for the acting commissioner, if I may, Mr. Chairman. I know something like 87% of your cases get certified as complex, mm-hmm. now, which gives you more time under the guidelines to resolve cases. And that number was surprisingly high to me when I learned of it in response to an inquiry I made to the department. I wonder if you could help me understand why that is the case. Because, I mean, the routine cases even contain multiple reasons why someone feels they may have been discriminated against. So how is that explained?
Well, Commissioner.
Thank you, Senator Latz and Mr. Chair. That is, I believe, the correct percentage of cases that designate as complex. The specific criteria for designating cases as complex I don't have with me here today. I would be more than happy, though, to get that specific criteria to you and the committee members on what we use to designate a case as complex.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, if I may. If you've just been fired and you think it was because of the color of your skin or your religion or because of your gender or because you were harassed, sexually harassed by a supervisor and they found some way to get rid of you, and if it takes, I think the average is like 450 days or something like that, to get a decision by the department on the merits if the case determines that there's a legitimate reason to do a full investigation, I mean, you're long past the time when you were fired or experienced the discrimination. And that's just not right in Minnesota. It should be better than that. And I understand if there's some you're not saying this, I understand, but it wouldn't surprise me, given the way the budgets have been squeezed, if there's also some organizational reason that there's an incentive to certify cases as complex, even when in the past they might not have been looked at quite as carefully and gone through through a faster response time. There just aren't the resources to do it adequately. But these are for people who have lost their jobs for particularly nefarious reasons, not because they messed up on the job, but for discriminatory reasons. They deserve, I think, faster and better response than they're able to get from an organization with such limited resources.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, I just had a couple of questions real quickly about what certain things mean. It said the number one area of discrimination was employment, followed by reprisal. Is that reprisal for employment-related reprisal or reprisals for what?
Commissioner.
Senator Marty and Mr. Chair, it would be not necessarily in that case, but in the corresponding employment case, but reprisal would be added on as another charge of discrimination because of the employee or a tenant or whoever the aggrieved person is will be subject to discrimination again because they filed a charge with us.
So in other words, Mr. Chairman, it's not related to employment. It could be renter or whatever, but it's that because they filed a charge with you that they were reprised. Okay, that's helpful. And then the other question I just had is you talk about what percentage go to dispute resolution. What percentage of the cases that are filed, I see about a tenth or 7 or 8% maybe of intakes are charges. What percentage of them are either through court or settlement does the charging party or the department's case win? Is it about half, about a third, about two-thirds? I mean, just ballpark.
Commissioner?
Yes, Senator Barney, Mr. Chair. The we get approximately 800 charges a year come into the department. 60% of them are dismissed for not warranting department resources for a full investigation. Current caseload for each investigator right now is about 35 cases. As far as making a case that goes all the way through determination, we have a no probable cause determination that discrimination did not occur or a probable cause determination. And approximately 10% of those cases that do make it through a full investigation are probable cause determinations.
Commissioner, when an individual has a complaint, do they have to file it through your office, or could they go directly to the courts and file a discrimination claim with the courts?
Yes, Mr. Chair, they can file directly into court if they would like. We're just another alternative, an option for an individual that feels they've been discriminated against. They do not need to be represented by an attorney to file a charge with our agency.
And is it cheaper to go through your agency or not versus a courtroom?
There is no cost to an individual to file, Mr. Chair.
No filing fees?
Correct. That is correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. On that point, you're saying that there are some that file them with the district court and not come through your purview. Do you know what that number is? Is there a way of tracking that number?
Commissioner.
Senator and Mr. Chair, I don't believe I know that number. If there's, we would just have to determine through the court system how many cases of discrimination have been filed and compared to what we get, but I don't have that number offhand.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could,
Senator Ingebrigtsen,
pointing to your handout here, you know, I noticed the 2010 calendar year, there's less charges than in 2009. Is that getting to be a trend? Are there getting to be less complaints?
Chair and Senator, it various reasons why the numbers fluctuate. It could be for more education and outreach has maybe educated people more that businesses or landlords are aware more of the laws and less people are coming in, and there could be a group of charges coming in from one particular employer where there it might increase the number. So there's a number of different things that could fluctuate.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Lath.
I think Senator Ingebrigtsen hit on a very good point, and I can tell you at least anecdotally within the bar of lawyers that practice in this field representing plaintiffs unlike the federal law, where you actually have to file a charge to preserve your federal rights, and then after 90 days you can withdraw it and go to court. You can go straight to court in Minnesota under state statute. And because the department is so backed up and has such limited resources, frankly, a lot of plaintiffs' lawyers just skip that stage altogether and will serve a lawsuit or file a lawsuit initially. So, in effect, when we shortchanged the department's resources, we probably increased the costs in the judiciary of dealing with lawsuits that might have otherwise been dealt with on the administrative level and through ADR or through the mediation that they are able to sponsor.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Acting Commissioner. I'm just wondering if one of the reasons that you have fewer cases is because of the economy and because of the number of jobs that are lost and that that people are not filing because they're afraid of people that are in jobs are afraid of losing their jobs. And if you expect that, if the economy improved, would you expect to see, have you ever tracked the economic impact of cases on your agency? Because I would assume that people would be very afraid to file charges that are holding on to their jobs by the skin of their teeth, and that there are so many unemployed right now. That might be a factor, and if that is so, that people might later file charges if the economy improves. Do you think, does that make any sense?
Yes, it does, Senator Goodwin. Mr. Chair, the economic situation and unemployment situation definitely does have an effect on the charges that are being filed. Obviously, if there are less people employed, there would be less charges filed, and I would agree with you that those that are employed would not want to risk anything happening at their employment for filing a charge, which, thank heavens, that's why we have the reprisal piece to our statute. So if that was indeed the case, they could file under that charge under that as well. But I believe that those are some probably very good reasons. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Commissioner, can you think of any areas where perhaps either because of the way the law is written or the way it's executed in practice that the department unreasonably interferes in contracts or unreasonably burdens business in Minnesota?
Senator, Mr. Chair, I don't believe that there is any anything that's unreasonably burdensome to a state contractor. The department provides a lot of outreach and technical assistance to businesses that do business with the state. One of the things we would like to do is keep the state contractors working for the state of Minnesota, complying with the affirmative action requirements, and keeping them out of the case processing area. The more education and information that they have that we provide them in complying with their affirmative action requirements, the less likelihood there will be that they will have employees filing charges of discrimination against them.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir.
Follow-up, Commissioner, thank you. I didn't mean to restrict that just to businesses that contract with the state. Just in general, businesses that face complaints, that face filings against them, that have document requirements to match up with, any area where you feel businesses are burdened and driving costs up in the state?
Yes, Senator, Mr. Chair. At this time, I don't believe so. I think that both the respondents, which would be the businesses or the employers or the landlords, and the people that file the charges of discrimination, as far as the state statute goes, they're treated equally, and there's as much information that we request coming from one party as we request coming from another in order that we can do a objective investigation. So it doesn't lean one way or the other. The law is enforced equally on both sides.
Commissioner, your agency is more like a reactor. You react to complaints. I may be wrong, but I don't believe your agency has a mechanism to go search out for complaints. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, we do have an education and outreach program where we go out to and do forums and showcases through various communities throughout the state of Minnesota to educate and inform them of the Human Rights Act. We do educational events and activities. The department has produced videos regarding the protection of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. We work with other agencies in the state that represent women and minorities, and we work with them to educate them so they can educate the people that they represent. Um, so So we go and try to educate to prevent discrimination.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. One more. I'm sorry. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as a for the committee, just as a follow-up to Senator Thompson's question, you know, it might not hurt us if we did take a look at this statute and this agency a little bit, because there may be some areas that we could assist the agency in resolving cases. And I'll just give you one quick example. Would be in the area of mediation and settlements, where an employment discrimination is alleged. The agency will assist in mediating and trying to settle the dispute, but won't share the investigation regarding the finding of probable cause. And that is something that, at least in my mind, if it was in a civil suit, would clearly be discoverable. But insofar as the agency is concerned, it is not. And it puts the employer in a very, very difficult position of trying to decide whether or not to settle. And I'm not talking about monetary settlement, because the employer really doesn't have anything other than the agency's determination of probable cause on which to base an evaluation to enter into a meaningful settlement agreement. So I do think that there are maybe some areas that we could explore and help the agency out in the future.
All right. Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I'm wondering if you have any data that you could give us that would show how we compare to other states of similar size with the number of human rights complaints that we receive. Do you have anything like that?
Commissioner.
Senator Hoffman, Mr. Chair, we could certainly request that information from similar-sized agencies or states that have departments of human rights. We know, you know, Iowa, for example, and Wisconsin and other states that are close to us. Not all states, Senator, have human rights laws that they enforce. But for the ones that we do, if we don't already have a study of it, we can certainly do something and get something back to you, get some
Thank
information
you.
Back to you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Ingebrigtsen?
No, thanks.
Any other questions? Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Appreciate your visit. Members, we that kind of concludes our testimony today. Probably next week we may be starting to hear bills. I've noticed that not too many members of this committee have bills coming to this committee, but if you have any that you're putting together, we're going to have a very ambitious schedule once we get into the bill considerations. So if you have them, love to see them and get them on the docket. Having no other business before the committee is adjourned.